Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I am John Milford, Executive Director of the San Francisco Towers and leader of the Grown-Ups Member-Led Forum here at the club, and your moderator for today's program. Today's program is generously underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. An early sign that traditional retirement arrangements were changing was seen across America when employers began shifting from defined benefit retirement plans or pensions to defined contribution plans, thus shifting economic risk from the company to the individual worker. But the past year has brought about a sea change in the way most pre-retirees view their retirement plans, as we watched the stock market turn 401k plans into 201k plans and 101k plans. Housing values and home equity losses have wiped out the wealth and credit lines that took decades to build. Many wage earners have lost jobs, as many as small American cities every month, month after month. We were said to be preparing too little as it was. And now this. What next? Now the baby boom generation, the largest in history at over 70 million, is at the threshold of retirement. A retirement that many think will be set back from 3 to 5 years, and that it will take at least 5 years for investments to get back to levels of 1 year ago. What of the unfunded expenses, the $75,000 per year and more for long-term care and assisted living not covered by Medicare and Medi-Cal? What of women's heightened concerns about outliving their financial resources? Our panel will be discussing these major issues and others in retirement and bringing us back to the basics of living within our means, extending our working years to lend purpose to life, and the value of family and friends in hard times. All this overarched by public policy and the influence that public policy has on the quality of life for future retirees. Please welcome our panel of experts. Our panelists are Carol Estes, PhD, and founder of the Institute of Health and Aging at UCSF. Gretchen Holstein, certified financial planner and investment advisor at Littman Gregory Asset Management. And Esther Koch, certified public accountant, gerontologist, and president of Encore Management. Let's begin with Carol Estes. Carol, as a social scientist, what is the truth as to whether Social Security will be there for us in the future? And is there a difference for between women and men with that regard?
Social Security will definitely be there for us and for future generations. It is a myth that Social Security is going bankrupt. It is the healthiest federal program that we have that is serving more than 45 million Americans. If we absolutely do nothing, Social Security has funding for 3.5 decades. We're talking about 35 years before the trust fund is spent down. But even after that, there is funding for Social Security for 75 to 80 years. And given the economic meltdown, the current economic meltdown, there is no greater argument for maintaining and improving this safety net for all Americans in Social Security. And I just want to add that it is a program about economic security and about families. Security for children. It's the largest public program of support for children in the United States. It's for disability, and surprisingly, we are told by epidemiologists that 20% of young people will have disability sometime in their lifetime before they become 65. And of course, it is for surviving children and widows and widowers who, in the case of 9/11, within 1 month's time, were covered by Social Security benefits that enabled their lives to go on, although broken and in great difficulty.
Thank you. A general question for Gretchen. What do people need to know and to do to supplement Social Security in the future?
Financial planners used to think of the resources for retirement as a three-pronged stool, Social Security being one, pension being another, and then your savings as a third. And I think years ago, we used to look at those three things as maybe being evenly distributed. As John mentioned earlier, there's been a major shift in the last 20 years or so from pensions, where you get an annual income that's set after retirement, to retirement savings plans, where you set your contribution in and you determine how it's invested, and then you deal with the potential source you have in retirement. So two of those prongs have changed quite a bit. The savings prong has had to become much more significant. And for some people, there is a lot of anxiety that the Social Security prong may become smaller. I think Carol's alleviated some of our fears on that. So the key thing for people to change in their thinking about retirement resources is how responsible they are becoming for saving for themselves. And I will say that saving is a skill that is not easily learned or taught. And unless you had someone in your life when you were young teaching you about saving and how to invest, it's not something that you see in school that often or that you learn from other people. And so that I think one of the major shifts we need to make in our educational program is teaching people from an early age about this responsibility.
Thank you. Esther, just by way of introduction, a question for you. Speaking as an elder care advisor, what is the most important to plan for in the role of a caregiver for an older parent or preparing yourself to be in need of care?
Thank you. Well, first of all, what I'd like to start with is that acknowledging aging is not giving into it. It's really not acknowledging aging is when you give into it, because really what happens is that you miss out on options. I think another important overlying thought is really aging is all about family. So don't wait to your deathbed to get the aha moment of what's important in life. I think there needs to be more forgiveness in the world because that family structure is so important. As a matter of fact, unpaid family caregivers, the value of those services provided is close to $250 billion a year. That's going to be the primary source of support. So what is, for you as you age, what is your social support network? Who are those people in your life? You need to focus on that social support network. You also want to stay healthy. The key there is exercise, exercise, exercise. That can have the most important impact on the quality of your life than anything else. That is really key. You want to be realistic about your care needs. This is another phase of life that there might come a time where you need some assistance. So what might that be? Who could possibly provide it? What would it cost? Is there some way to insure against those costs? And how will it be managed? And you want to initiate those conversations. Don't keep that all to yourself. It's think, plan, and act. Initiate conversations with that group of family and friends. And then you certainly want to get legal documents in place to support that and review those.
Here's a question that looks as though it's for Gretchen. Gretchen, for recent college graduates, what types of retirement portfolios are appropriate? Should we start an IRA? Should we engage in riskier stocks? What's your advice?
Well, first I have to say that I'm awfully proud that we got that question. I'm hoping that it came from a college graduate instead of the college graduate's parent, because as I said earlier, I like to see people planning for saving earlier. First of all, as you enter your earning and spending life, there are some things that you need to make sure are taken care of before you start planning for retirement savings. And that's to make sure, and this is a good rule of thumb actually for anyone at any age, that you have set aside what I call emergency money. So in the case that something comes up, you have to fix something, you lose your job and you need to pay your rent, if you own a house like I've experienced, we have a pipe that breaks in the backyard, you know, any of these things that come up unexpectedly, you need to have an emergency pool set aside first. So I think for college graduates, my first suggestion is start putting money to set aside for that kind of issue. The typical rule of thumb that you hear about emergency money is 3 to 6 months worth of regular spending. I don't agree with that typical rule of thumb. I would say put at least 9 months away, 9 months of your spending away as an emergency pool. I think especially with the issues that we're dealing with recently with unemployment, it may take people longer to get new jobs. Having a cushion of savings is helpful. Then what I love for people to do when they start the workforce is get to know their 401k plan or whatever retirement plan is offered through their work, and to save at least as much as is matched by the company they're working for. It is such a huge shame that so many young workers today do not put a siphon off a piece of their income into their retirement accounts that then doesn't get taxed as income to them today. So actually, it feels like a lot less that they're losing into the retirement account because it would get taxed before it came to them for spending anyway. And then oftentimes, the companies they work for have at least a minimal matching program. So their savings get matched, sometimes one for one, up to 3 to 5% of their income. So once you have an emergency pool, then take advantage of tax-deferred savings accounts and especially at least up to the amount that you're getting matched. And in terms of the should I get into riskier stocks part of the question, I feel like there is a rule of thumb that the younger you are, the more that you can afford to put into stocks. And that is true from the sense that if it's your retirement money, you have more years to ride the roller coaster of the stock market. However, what I see people do in reality is they get anxious and they shift their retirement money right when they shouldn't. So the market goes down, it makes them anxious, and they can't stay so much in stocks anymore because they're anxious, and then they shift it when it's down. After it's gone back up, then they shift it back in. Or typically what I see is, especially younger investors who haven't had a lot of experience with this yet, they pick the investment that did the best last year, and that's the one to get into for this year, which is usually exactly the wrong time to do it. So although typically you can't afford to put more in stocks when you're younger, I would say put as much in as you are going to feel comfortable having in for the long term when it goes down and when it goes through roller coasters. And that may be less for you than your neighbor, but do what's appropriate.
Thank you. I have a follow-up question for Carol on the topic of Social Security, and it is whether you recommend taking Social Security benefits at age 62 rather than age 65, pros and cons?
That is a very good question. Early retirement and
taking Social Security at age 62, it has been a major trend. And I would, in general, advise against taking it out at age 62 and waiting until what is the normal retirement age. For people who are not yet 65, that retirement age is gradually moving up to age 67. And one can not withdraw until their 70s. But there is a 20% penalty presently every year for your withdrawing your Social Security at age 62. That compounds over time to quite a significant amount, and that penalty is going up to 30% in the next couple of years. So there is a huge penalty for taking the funds out at 62. However, if you have a life expectancy or know your life expectancy is not going to last until normal retirement age as it's defined, then it would make sense to do that. And obviously, if you have no other source of income, retiring at age 62 will be a at least defined benefit source of income. There is no question that many, many more Americans with the high double-digit unemployment rates that we are beginning to experience and higher in some states are now retiring or considering retiring earlier because of the difficulties in securing jobs. And that is another reason why Social Security is so important as a secure base of retirement income.
All right, thank you. Esther, maybe you would address this follow-up question. Assuming average life expectancies, when husband and wife are the same age, what's the best strategy for when to start collecting Social Security benefits for a couple?
Well, I think the points that Carol made in terms of what your situation is, it's really individual to the situation. I would also say that health and well-being of each individual would be important, again, individually. Another aspect is if anyone is working, that there is, if Social Security is taken prior to full retirement age, there's a penalty where your benefit will be reduced against what you would have received under early retirement. That penalty doesn't exist if you take Social Security at full retirement. So it really is individual. Another aspect would be whether in the husband and wife situation, whether the wife has her own Social Security record or whether she is earning Social Security based on her husband's record or actually even vice versa. So you are allowed the higher of either amount that you might otherwise be eligible for. So I would say that it's really on an individual basis, looking at people's health and longevity, whether they're working, and then exactly what the amounts are for each individual.
Thank you very much. This is another policy question, and so I'd like to ask Carol to start on this one. And it has to do with group housing. This is a concept that's taking hold in some parts of the country, including the East Bay. Provides a happy medium of mixed-age housing under a common roof, but with separate living facilities, common lounge and amenities. Should this be encouraged and perhaps subsidized as a matter of public policy?
Personally, I favor the concept of group housing. I think that there's no question that millions of elders living at home alone as individuals in houses creates great difficulty in terms of securing transportation and caregiving support, or may create difficulties, but housing is a vital and important area, and to bring services to those housing settings is
in an economical, more efficient way, and a broader array of services, as well as transportation to health care and so forth, is much more possible and affordable in such settings. And I do believe if it's the choice of elders to live in those environments, they will enjoy it. Having done my very first research project many, many years ago, was looking at the effects of different housing environments such as those on the health and well-being of the elderly. And those that make the option and really see the benefits, it's an enormous positive for their health.
Thank you. For our listening audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking with a panel of experts about what you do and do not know about planning for your own retirement. Our panelists are Carol Estes, PhD and founder of the Institute of Health and Aging at UCSF, Gretchen Holstein, certified financial planner and investment advisor at Littman Gregory Asset Management, and Esther Koch, certified public accountant, gerontologist, and president of Encore Management. And now I think a question for Gretchen. And that has to do with whether you would recommend a HELOC for someone who has that option as a retirement vehicle.
First, before I answer the question, I'll describe to the audience what that acronym stands for. It's HELOC, Home Equity Line of Credit. So as you can imagine, this was one of the areas that people were taking, well, in my office we were referring to it as using your house as an ATM machine. It was a way for you to get spendable money out of owning a house without increasing your mortgage, specifically your mortgage loan. When advising people on home equity lines of credit, first of all, what we look at is how much this will in turn make the loan percentage versus the equity in their house, because any mortgage lender is going to look at a HELOC, home equity line of credit, as a loan on your house, just like they look at a mortgage on your house. So if you wanted the opportunity to refinance, which a lot of people have tried to do recently because rates have been very low, home equity lines of credit can hurt you because they are another loan on your house. However, for short-term projects, home equity lines of credit rates have also been very low. So I think if you're using them for the original purpose of a home equity line of credit, which is to potentially put an improvement on the house, and it's not a large percentage of the debt on the house, it can be a very good tool. I would definitely suggest shopping around. There are places that have been offering home equity line of credit rates at prime and sometimes below prime, although recently prime's come down so much that I haven't seen it below prime. So don't necessarily just go to your bank for the current rate. The last thing I'll mention that you need to consider with home equity line of credit is that the interest can be deductible, like your mortgage interest, as long as you are using the home equity line of credit money towards your house. If you take out the loan and use it towards something else, like buying a car, it may not be tax deductible. And then there's also some situations in alternative minimum tax where it's not tax deductible. So before you take out a HELOC, also consult your CPA or your tax preparer, your tax accountant, to make sure that you know how the interest rate's going to be affected for you.
Thank you very much. Here are two questions, and I think we'll ask Esther to address these for starters. My husband and I are able to help care for our parents. However, we don't have children to help care for us. We don't have any nieces or nephews. I don't have any cousins. Is there anything that I should do that is different or unique to plan for my health care going forward? I am 51. And the second question is like unto it. how do I evaluate whether it is worthwhile to purchase long-term care insurance?
Okay, the first question in terms of if you are in a situation where you don't have children that could potentially be there for you, and I do say potentially be there for you as you age, and this goes back to aging is all about family, but what is also important is family by choice. It doesn't necessarily have to be blood relationships. It's those relationships that are truly like family. And sometimes we find that those are the relationships and those are the support structure that really will come to your aid, possibly before family. So actually what I tell people is, you know, make younger friends. And it's not just acquaintances. It's really, really a friendship and being there and being a part of community. Maybe it's a greater community, but I think social support structure is really very important to aging, but just because you don't have that, that's my situation. I don't have children. I happen to get adopted into a lot of families, and I'm very conscious of that. So to have a friend, you have to be a friend. And the second part
has to do with the advisability of long-term care insurance.
I am very much a proponent of long-term care insurance. It is a way to insure against the potential costs of long-term care. And I think that the probability that you will have some care needs as you grow older is probably greater than the possibility that you'd trigger your home contents insurance policy. So it is definitely a way to insure against those potential risks of long-term care expenses. So I would say definitely it's something to look into, and you do have to be careful in terms of reading the policies and what they cover.
All right, Carol, you have something to
add? I would like to add to that and to say that long-term care insurance in the private market is not complete coverage of all the expenses that one will have. And we already know that Medicare does not provide coverage for long-term care except for very, very short periods, often post-hospitalization in a nursing home or some kind of rehabilitation facility. We need to be working toward public long-term care insurance as well. This is a public and private partnership area. Right now, the private partnership is mainly the millions of caregivers who are providing 80% of the long-term care who are not paid. These are largely women who are often leaving the job market, taking salary cuts, having benefit losses and so forth, making enormous sacrifices. And we definitely need to be working toward the public part of long-term care support beyond mere Medicaid, which is there for those people who are at or below poverty in most cases. So I just want to emphasize that we do have a public citizenry responsibility, I believe, looking forward to our aging society and participating in it to develop public options as well, and including chronic care management and other things that should come in under or health reform. Thank you.
Here's a topic that hasn't come up yet, but I think people are most interested in it, and that has to do with the pros and cons of reverse mortgages. I wonder, Gretchen, if you would say something about this, and then if the others would like to add, discussing the pros and cons of reverse mortgages and at what age are they appropriate.
Okay, first I will tell you I'm not an insurance expert, but essentially a reverse mortgage is a kind of an insurance type vehicle where you slowly pay back or give back the value of your house for in exchange for income payments. So a lot of people want to stay in their house, want to continue owning their house, but it's become one of their biggest assets in their retirement savings. And a reverse mortgage is the way to tap into that. I'm a little cautious as a certified financial planner. I'm cautious about them because they are expensive in the sense that the income payment that you get from them can be quite low compared to what you might get on a typical asset that's the same value. So you are paying for this opportunity. I would typically suggest it as kind of a last resort for income for someone who was able to stay in their home, wanted to stay in their home. Although I also agree with Carol that in a lot of cases, some of the best living arrangements for people as they age are with other people. So I can't even say that I'm always 100% supportive of someone staying by themselves in their home. But there can be situations where a reverse mortgage can be useful. And I'll pass it along to Carol and Esther to comment as well.
Esther, do you have something?
Well, I think based on our most recent financial meltdown, and I question whether banks and lending institutions will see that as a instrument that they will be marketing as much as they might have marketed previously, because it's all based on there was appreciation in a home. So I'm not sure that there is going to be the availability of those types of financing instruments as there might have been in the future, in the past.
All right. Here's a question of a different type, and this comes from the person that is not in a company that provides a 401k or has that type of arrangement for preparing for retirement as an official vehicle. How does a person who works hourly or periodically prepare for retirement? Gretchen?
People who are self-employed, which might be different than hourly, so I'll address that first. Mm-hmm. If you are either running a business yourself or working as a contractor or periodically doing projects for people as a kind of an incorporated business, then you can open up a retirement account for yourself. The simplest form of that is called a simplified employee pension plan, or as the industry refers to it, as a SEP, S-E-P. And it's a very simple, straightforward way to take up to 25% of your compensation, which is your earnings, but taking into account that you have some self-employment tax, taking 25% of it and setting it aside into a retirement account before it gets taxed. So it's like putting money in a 401k plan. If what you're doing is hourly work but you're not self-employed, maybe you're working for a corporation, but you don't have access to a retirement plan like a 401k plan, you may be and are most likely eligible to make a tax-deductible contribution to a regular IRA account. And IRA contribution limits have gone up significantly in the last few years. So you can put money away into an IRA and take it off your taxable income for the year. Now, people can make IRA contributions. Other people can make IRA contributions also. They just may not be able to deduct them from their taxes. But there are other ways to get money into tax-deferred retirement-type savings accounts, even if you don't have a typical 401k-type plan through your company.
All right. Here's a general question for Carol, and that has to do with how does the baby boomers' massive population affect our children's retirement possibilities?
The baby boom generation, which is from persons born in from 1946 to 1964, is about 75 million Americans, a number of whom are now approaching, if not achieving, retirement age, depending on how you call that. Some people call age 60 a retirement age, but 60 or 65. There is no question that there is going to be a significant demand for long-term care caregiving, which is going to be difficult for the younger generation, the children and grandchildren of those parents who may actually have their own children and their parents and their grandparents. We are now finding many more 4 and 5 generation families. So this is called the sandwich generation, but it's a triple decker going to a quadruple decker in some cases. And this is quite a bit of concern, and that is part of the reason that I pointed to the need for us to do the work to achieve long-term care as a public and private partnership with public policy supporting it. Now, in a country like Germany, which has a national long-term care system, every caregiver who is not a paid caregiver, like the family members taking care, are covered under Social Security. They get credits as if they are working under Social Security, and they get disability coverage should they become disabled doing this. They are already making economic sacrifices. So I think younger generations, this is really an intergenerational issue that the baby boomers are going to have needs. But one of the important things about long-term care many people don't recognize is that over 41% of people needing long-term care are under age 65. And epidemiologists say with the rising obesity and diabetes and a variety of health issues that confront us, that we may not have the progression to living longer, healthier. We may live longer, but less healthy. So that would be my answer.
Thank you very much. We had spoken a few minutes earlier about group living or co-housing as an option, and I'm just wondering, now that it exists, if Esther or Carol or Gretchen would care to comment on how to choose a group living or co-housing environment.
I'll take that first. I would like to make the statement for baby boomers. I actually think that you will be finding more and more baby boomers who are going to choose some type of congregate living environment. And also to the extent where, as one of the other questions alluded to, I don't have children or families are dispersed, that I think you're going to find like-minded people coming together to share the responsibilities and build community and share responsibilities as one ages. So a lot of those models are yet to be developed. Some of the models that you have today on group living, we tend to think of independent living, then assisted living, and skilled nursing. And some models have a continuity of care, so it's those three put together. I think a lot has to do with the type of person you are and what your needs are. And all of these, there's no one model for each of those. They are all very different. And if we're thinking primarily of independent living and assisted living, where there might be some care needs, there's no one individual model out there. They are all variations on a theme. So you really want to go to the community, see if they look like like-minded people to you, get referrals, talk to residents who live in the community to see whether you think that that's the type of environment that you would be happy in and would fulfill your needs. And then clearly there's going to be a cost element to that. So where does that fit with your ability to pay? So I think that would be one way to start looking at those.
Okay. Gretchen?
I just wanted to add, from the perspective of being able to pay, that one of the things that I've encouraged my clients to do is to ask a lot of questions about the costs and how they change over the years, what's additional if you move into different levels of services, if you want to do different types of activities, and how much the costs inflate, because they will likely go up each year, and it may be more than typical inflation, or it might be about inflation. So when you are projecting whether or not the monthly or annual fees are affordable, you keep in mind that they will probably go up, so your resources need to go up in tandem, and they will probably change as the services change.
Okay. Gretchen, a financial question for you that begs a short answer. Can you trade on margin in a retirement plan?
The brokerage firms that I've worked with do not allow margin on retirement accounts.
Okay. Since you had such a short question, here is a question from a young person looking to invest money in the stock market long term. How do you recommend starting?
I heard from the audience cautiously. I think that's probably. I think that investing, we should follow one of Warren Buffett's famous pieces of advice, which is that you should only invest in things that you understand. And the second piece of advice that I would say is that you need to stay involved in your investments. This is not something that you can set up once based on what you hear me answer today and then not look at again in the coming months, in the coming years. And I kind of liken it to re-landscaping your garden. You may bring in an expert to help you re-landscape your garden and choose things that are appropriate for you and the soil where you live, and make sure it's diversified in different types of investments or different types of plants, but they grow differently too over time. Some plants don't make it, some investments don't make it. You may need to replace them. Some things grow too much and need to be trimmed back. Same thing with investments. So my first suggestion is to start conservative and start taking some classes. Learn about the investments that you might make and make sure that they are balanced between growth and income-oriented things, so balanced between stocks and bond-oriented things. And I say that even though the question was from a young person and you'd think I would say they should be highly invested in stocks, but in actuality, like I said earlier, what we see people do is they tend to make investment decisions at exactly the wrong time because they get spooked by what's happening in the stock market. So I really believe that there needs to be a balance between stocks and bonds. And you can tap into the internet for lots of information about investments. You can tap into your local independent brokerage firms like Schwab and Fidelity and TD Ameritrade for investment seminars that are pretty objective to learn about different types of investments.
I like the way you likened your profession to an economic landscaper.
Mm-hmm.
Just in a short time, can you give some advice as to some of the most important considerations a person should take into account in deciding on a financial planner?
On a financial planner? Well, first of all, they should be a certified financial planner, which is the acronym CFP. This means that they've been through an extensive education program and a fairly rigorous exam process and are knowledgeable in a number of different financial areas. Everything from investments to tax and insurance planning, and then they will likely be able to refer you to specialists in the areas where they do not practice. And second of all, I like to see people hire a financial planner that is compensated in a way that they can remain objective, that their compensation is not tied to the things that they're recommending, but more tied to the person. So the person is paying them and then getting objective advice. And you should feel free to ask questions about compensation. I hear so often that people will tell me that they're not really sure how their current planner gets paid. And they're a little uncomfortable asking. Maybe it was referred to them by a friend, and so there's a friendship relationship there, and they feel uncomfortable. So I guess my third piece of advice is don't just ask your friends and family for referrals to financial professionals. Ask the financial professionals who they would refer their family to. And you may have contacts with some financial professionals, but anyone you call, I mean, people do call me and ask me who I refer business to if it doesn't meet our business. So I think, you know, people do know each other in the industry, so that's a good source of referrals too.
All right. Thank you very much. I'd like to switch back to a question for Esther. What is the most commonly overlooked or underestimated aspect of retirement planning, in your opinion?
I think that most people, when they think about retirement planning, think about the financial aspect of it. But really, retirement, I think what is just as important, if not even more important, is the health and well-being aspect of retirement. Maintaining one's health is really critical to the quality of life that you will have as you age. And also, I think when people think of retirement, they think of finances and they're ready to plan for it. But if you say aging, people don't want to deal with it and don't want to plan for it. But they really are interchangeable. So I'm not afraid to use the word aging, and I don't think you should be either. So on the health side, it's physical health and mental health. And again, if I had to come with a message that I hope you take and act on it, it's exercise, exercise, exercise. Is truly going to be significantly improve the quality of your life as you age. Then there's the aspect of your emotional well-being. And here is this whole social support network that is going to be so key to, again, the quality of life as you age. And then there's also your purpose in life. So as you leave, clearly you had responsibilities if you were raising children, and that was so much of a part of your life. And if you were in the workforce, your career was so important. As you move away from those, what is going to be your purpose in life? So it's very important to think about that. And most people do, as one ages, we get beyond ourselves. It's important. You're important, and it's those who appreciate themselves enough to care for your physical and mental health. And then it's a greater purpose in life. So what's going to be your contribution, and how might that plan out? So it's that aspect of retirement that I think far too many people don't spend the time to think about and nurture.
A word for our listening audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking with a panel of experts about what to do and what not to do in retiring, planning your retirement. Our panelists are Carol Estes, PhD and founder of the Institute of Health and Aging at UCSF, Gretchen Holstein, certified financial planner and investment advisor at Littman Gregory Asset Management, and Esther Koch, certified public accountant, gerontologist, and president of Encore Management. I'd like to move over to public policy again and ask Carol. We had a question here about policy that I thought we should mention, and it has to do with Big Pharmacy has just announced a huge subsidy for seniors. What other measure can be taken short of full medical and dental coverage to improve the lot of seniors with regard to their health care in the future?
I'm so glad this question was asked, because it brings us to the important link between Medicare, which is a form of enormous security for the elderly and disabled, and research shows has
contributed significantly to health improvements in this population. And the long-term care issue is one of those issues that should be part of health care reform, if not now, in the near future. As well, however, the future for Medicare is very dependent on our structure of health care delivery and financing. And in that regard, the cost containment mechanisms that are included in whatever health reform we pass at the current time or develop are crucial for Medicare, because the cost rises under Medicare are actually less than the cost rises under private health insurance plans because of the lower administrative costs under Medicare. So we cannot deal with Medicare's financial problems without having cost containment across the health system writ large, which brings me to the point of the importance of a public plan incorporated in, that is, a public health option in the healthcare reform that people under age 65 could draw on, because that, in a sense, is understood to be one of the biggest and most important elements of cost containment writ large across the system, which will also help Medicare. The other aspect is that we do need to level the playing field, which this would do, between traditional Medicare and private insurers. And there has been a $177 billion surplus that is currently part of Medicare law that would be spent in the next 10 years that health reformers are thinking about, and the President Obama has recommended be abolished to level the playing field and to provide resources to pay for health reform. No question, long-term care and adult day services, day health services, social supportive services are crucial, and we need to be working for that. So we need an elder-empowered engagement process also. Each of us need to think about how we can be active in contributing to our community and to our children's and grandchildren's community, and this is one way. Thank you.
Carol, a follow-on question. People are more and more citizens of the world and travel extensively. Generally, Medicare doesn't cover medical outside the country, but I wonder if you have any word of advice or even forecast as to whether that would change for Americans?
That's a very good question, and it's not something about which I have a lot of expertise. I don't know if there's a global traveler on the panel that would be able to address this. I do believe that we are going to, with universal health care, to the extent that we move to that, we will have coverage. That is, the whole point is to have coverage that's portable, that goes from state to state and covers one.
And I can speak to, there is medical travel insurance, which I definitely tell those of my clients who are over 65 to take on any trip where they go out of the country.
All right, thank you. Gretchen, let's see, we had an ancillary question. Where is the best place to retire in the U.S. from a financial standpoint?
Well, I can't speak from experience yet. I did hear an interesting piece of advice many, many years ago about that's related to this question about where to retire, and that's that if you, when you are younger, buy a piece of property that's on one of the coasts, that those areas are likely to be populated or popular with people who are retiring or going into more traditional retirement, so that your asset may increase in the same rate or in a rate high enough to help you cover the cost of a retirement home someday, even if it's in a different place on the coast. So just from that comment alone, I'm thinking that there are a lot of people will want to retire somewhere on the coast. Another interesting comment I heard recently was that places that are hot now may continue to get hotter and be less attractive for retiring, which makes Arizona possibly a less attractive retirement community. But from a financial planner's point of view, I think what's really important for me to know from my clients is what we talk about is how they would envision their day-to-day life going, what community they want to be in, what activities they want to pursue. And once you can envision how your daily life may be or who you want to be near, I think that's going to determine where the best place to retire is. And then you can gather information about that place and how the expenses might look for a place like that and build that into your projections for the future, which kind of supports one of the points that I think we have been talking about but may not have said explicitly, and that's that the best time to be thinking about retirement is well before you retire, well before. Envisioning it, playing with ideas, thinking about how your day is going to be, who you're going to be with, what your activities will be, how you feel like you will be able to make a contribution, how you will feel success, how you will define success. I think thinking about those things well in advance will make these types of decisions a lot easier. Where should I retire? When should I retire? How should I make decisions for myself today that'll get me there? So that may help answer the location question, too.
I'd also like to add that I know that AARP does a study, actually, and I believe it comes out annually with just the answer to that particular question. I don't recall what the best location is this year, but I can say that as they looked, but again, you have to be thinking of what is appropriate for you and your interests. But once you get past that, one of the things that I recall was consistent amongst these places is that there tended to be a university setting, and that university setting tended to have a hospital medical facility. And so within a university setting or area, there tends to be more intergenerational interaction. There seems to be your medical support systems are there. And also culturally and community, there is more activities that are going on that you might participate in.
All right. Thank you very much. And here's a question from the edge of the cosmos. And I think I'd like to ask this first to Carol. Carol, if you could relay one lesson to your younger self about your experiences and what you know now, what would that be regarding retirement? What would you tell your younger self?
Education, education, education. There is a long line of research that shows the earlier you get your education and the more you continue it, the higher your economic and health security will be. And there is an enormous parallel between that. So continuing education, lifelong education, but also education of those in your family and around you so that you are in a network of support of people who are informed and up with it on the outer edge as we go there.
All right. Esther, would you care to comment on that? A lesson to your younger self?
The lesson to my younger self would be to have a friend, you have to be a friend. And that would be something that I have certainly tried to do. Actually, that was my mother's motto, and it really has held true for me. And it's something that I should have even done more of. But that would be the one the one phrase that I would think of. To have a friend, you have to be a friend. And then I would be working on creating moments of joy wherever I could with the people that I love, and I would let them know I love them, and when in doubt, forgive.
Thank you. Gretchen?
I feel fortunate that when I was younger, I was taught to have a savings mentality, and I think I was that was a unique thing that I learned from my family. What I wish I had also learned was something that Esther brought up earlier, which is to have an exercise mentality, that as much as you take care of your finances, you need to take care of your physical self. And that's still a lesson I'm working on. So,
something more practical, and again for Gretchen, if you have a debt and retirement accounts, is it better to pay off the debt with the money in the retirement accounts?
Paying off debt with retirement account money becomes truly a tax question. It depends, first of all, on the kind of debt. If it's mortgage debt, then the interest may be tax deductible, so you need to take into account what the attractiveness is of the tax deductibility of it. If it's a different kind of debt, it may not be tax deductible, but every dollar you take out of your retirement account is taxable. So the answer to that question is going to need an assessment of your tax profile and your tax situation. If it is a high income tax year for you, it may really hurt to take money, more money out of a retirement account, pay taxes on it just to pay down debt that may have tax deductible interest in it. However, I think there's two sides of looking at debt. One is from a financial perspective, how much can you afford and is it a good rate and so on and so forth. The other side of it, which I hear a lot, is the emotional side. Some people really do not feel comfortable being in debt. It's a personal decision, and you have to balance how much debt you're comfortable with the financial benefit maybe of being in debt. So that answer is a very individual situation answer.
All right. We have time for one more question. And I'd like to ask all three panelists to consider this. This question a year ago would have been a prescient and brilliant question to ask, but now it's quite popular. What is the most important financial planning tip to prepare for a recession and retirement? Esther.
Live within your means.
Could you expand on that a little bit?
I think that in many respects, we are a very consumer-driven society. And in the past, we haven't lived within our means. In prior generations, for example, the home was fully paid off. There were usually no mortgages for a home, so that was the nest egg that people had. And that's not the situation now. So the nest egg isn't there, pensions aren't there, that I do believe people need to live within their means throughout their lifetime.
So does this mean we go to cash? How does that work? Is it safer to just have things in cash?
No, that's more of an living within your means is more of an expense side. You're asking an investment question. That's a whole other question for Gretchen. Is there still a financial market to invest in today?
Well, there is, absolutely. But how you invest in it and how you proportion different types of investments for you is the key answer. And to address the cash question, I think one of the best ways to recession-proof your situation is to have cash or very conservative money set aside for when in retirement, a year or two worth of living expenses. I mean, those people that last year had 2 years worth of living expenses set aside didn't like seeing what was happening in their investment portfolio, but it did not affect their spending, their being able to pay their mortgage the next day. The other piece of advice that I would give is don't get return greedy.
people tend to want to jump on the things that have had good returns in the past and then get themselves overexposed to those things, which then tend to be the things that have the biggest downturns and recessions. So good enough is good enough. You don't have to get the bragging rights for the next cocktail party.
Thank you, Gretchen. Our time is about gone. We want to take time, however, to thank our panelists, Carol Estes, Gretchen Holstein, Esther Koch. We also thank our audiences here for their pertinent questions, our audience on the radio for listening, and remember, if you're eager to continue this conversation, join us on the internet at commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. I am John Milford, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.